promising that their forces wouldn't come anywhere near the Turkish borders. But there was a restrictive amendment that said, as long as the Turkish government doesn't force us to change our attitude.
And?
In his reply, Inonu thanked Hitler appropriately, but then he added a restriction using, more or less, Hitler's wording.
What did he say?
He said, as long as the German government doesn't take measures that force Turkey to change their friendly attitude. Tit for tat, in other words. Hitler has always addressed the weaker countries harshly. Perhaps Inonu's proud, almost haughty manner baffled him a bit. This conversation would have continued had it not been for Sabiha joining them. She was holding a letter and some photographs.
Look, Majid. A letter sent ages ago has finally arrived today. Selva sent some pictures of little Fazıl.
She glanced at her father. The little boy must have grown since she sent this letter. Children change so quickly at this age.
Have a look, darling. Isn't he cute? His eyes and nose are exactly like Selva's.
Majid looked at the photographs nonchalantly, avoiding eye contact with his father-in-law, and put them back in the envelope.
Yes, very nice.
Don't you agree that he looks like Selva, especially around the mouth?
Sabiha, I was in the middle of an important conversation with your father.
You're always like that. Whatever you're talking about is so important,
she said angrily. Sabiha laid the envelope with the photographs on the small table where her father could see it, and left. Fazıl Reşat Paşa didn't look. He poured himself a little more rakı from the small carafe.
Let me get some more ice for you, Majid said, going to the kitchen.
The so-called ice box was a small wooden cupboard lined with zinc. They would buy large blocks of ice from a restaurant, break them up, and put the ice in the box. Inside the ice box were some long brown bottles of tekel beer. A carafe of water was crammed between the bottles. Leman Hanum had had the icebox brought by a porter from the summer villa to the Asian side of Istanbul, and from there by rail to Ankara. When the maid saw Majid trying to break off some ice, she tried to stop him.
Please, sir, let me do that. I need to wash it as well after breaking it up.
Majid returned to where his father-in-law was sitting. He saw the old man looking through the photographs one by one, placing them back in the envelope with shaking hands. Majid went back to the kitchen on tiptoe so as not to disturb him. Marseille. Reading the newspaper, Selva saw the sickening headline. According to the latest edict issued by the Vichy government, all Jews were required to register themselves and their belongings with the authorities. Those who didn't comply would be penalized and sent to concentration camps. There was also a list published of those being sent to the camps because they hadn't obeyed the instructions or were late doing so. Selva trembled as she read through the list. Luckily, Raffo's name hadn't been registered on any of the pharmacy's legal papers. All the same, the Vichy administration, with its spies and hunting dogs, was even more efficient at tracing Jews than the Nazis themselves. What if they found out that Benoit's mother was Jewish? She didn't even want to think about that now. Many Turks, particularly from Istanbul, had migrated to France after the First World War, settling mainly in Paris, Lyon, and Marseille. Later, the children of these families intermarried with the French and produced their own families. Benoit's mother was one such case. She had moved to France with her family from Istanbul and married a Frenchman who was not of the Jewish faith when she was 21. Benoit and his mother would go to Istanbul every year for their summer holiday. During these holidays, they would spend some time with the Alfandaris in their Tarabya house. Who knew how many times they swam there in the dark blue waters of the Bosphorus, played hide-and-seek in the groves on its hills, and fished along its shores. Before the Germans occupied Paris, when Raffo was desperately seeking a safe base for his family somewhere, it was Benoit who had suggested that they go to Marseille.
He offered to make Rafo a partner in his pharmacy once he had sorted out his financial situation. There were a few friends of Selva's family who had gone to France at this time. Selva read the lists in the newspaper with fear in her heart that she would come across any of their names. Doenyas, Alhadef, Eskenazi. Some names looked familiar. Eskenazi. Wasn't that the surname of her grandmother's poker partner, Esther Hanum? Her now deceased grandmother, who had been so unhappy when they decided to move to Paris? Selva would ask Rafa when he came home for lunch. Surely he would know who was who. But what was the point? He would be so upset if he knew any of them. Young Fazl sat on his potty as she continued to read the newspaper. The baby started to scream at exactly the same time that the telephone started to ring. He must have some sort of built-in mechanism, she thought.
Un moment, s'il vous plaît,
she answered, and rushed back to Fazl. By then, he had overturned the potty, and it took some time to empty the pot, clean up, and wipe him.
My God, she said to herself, I forgot the telephone.
She picked up the receiver, worried that the caller had hung up.
Hello? Hello?
A man's voice replied.
Selva Hanum, this is Taro Karuja speaking. Your sister gave me your number. I'm the second secretary at the Turkish consulate in Paris. Oh, Taruk Bey. Of course I know who you are. Sabiha has mentioned you in her letters so often.
That's so nice of her.
I'm sorry I seem to have called at an inopportune moment. I can call back at a more convenient time if you wish.
No, Taruk Bey, it's fine now. Please don't hang up. I was just changing my son's... I was just going to put him to bed. He's playing happily now. Oh, Taruk Bey, I do miss home so much. Especially talking to you right now. I've missed speaking my own language. It's perfectly all right to speak now.
I promised your sister that I'd call you as soon as I got to Paris. Unfortunately, I've been extremely busy since I arrived. I couldn't call you sooner. Things here are rather hectic. Anyway, I bring you lots of love and regards. I also have a couple of things for you. I'll try to send them to you as soon as I can.
There's no hurry. Perhaps you could give them to somebody who is coming down here. Please don't send them by post. I'm not sure I would get them.
You're right. I know that we are sending a courier to our consulate in Marseille next week. I'll send your things then.
Did you have a good trip, Taruk Bey? Did you get through without being harassed by the Germans?
Selva asked in an attempt to prolong the conversation. Apart from the few occasions when she spoke to her mother or sister, and of course Rafo, she had no opportunity to speak Turkish to anyone. She hadn't admitted, even to herself, that she missed using her mother tongue. At this moment, she was trying to satisfy her longing by speaking to a man she hardly knew. Listening to him was like breathing Istanbul air.
My journey was very tiring. I couldn't get a direct train from Istanbul on the date I wanted. I had to travel to Edirne by bus. A very ramshackle old bus indeed. Then a dreadful train from Edirne to Varna. From there, I took an equally dreadful steamboat to Kostenja, where I boarded yet another train. The carriages were freezing and there was nothing to eat. The Germans often stopped the train for checks, but I must say, they were all right with me. We kept changing trains. It was quite an adventure, but I am here now.
Welcome, said Selva wholeheartedly. In fact, I have been waiting for your call. From the way Sabiha has written about you, I feel I have a close friend in France, even if we are in different cities.
Thank you, Selva Hanum. Is everything okay down there? Please don't hesitate to call me if you need anything.
We're managing for the time being.
I hope both you and your husband have your Turkish passports.
We do, but we applied for our French citizenship, so Rafo didn't extend his.
That's a big mistake. You should go immediately to our consulate in Marseille and put all your papers in order. I urge you to do this. In fact, I urge you to do this immediately today.
Really? I'll tell Rafo when he gets home. We were a little embarrassed. I mean, anyway, I'll tell him when he comes in.
Selva Hanum, Please, call me Selva.
Please give me a little time to call you this, Selva Hanum. I'll call our consulate in Marseille today and give them your names. There's nothing to feel embarrassed about. You must ask for Nazım Kender. He's our consul there. I will put him in the know right away.
Selva became very quiet. She didn't know what to say to this man she hardly knew, and yet who was so concerned about them.
Selva Hanum, for God's sake, I'm telling you, do as I say without delay. If your Turkish papers are in order, they can't touch you.
Thank you, Tarık Bey, she said shakily. Thank you for your concern. I feel as though my sister put you up to this, but...
I assure you this is serious. It has nothing to do with Sabiha Hanum.
Look, Selva Hanum, I don't know if I should be telling you this, but according to a reliable source, the German army is to move south very soon. The occupation will spread. If you don't have your papers in order, you may be very sorry. You can't say I haven't warned you.
He was very serious. His voice had changed entirely. He didn't prolong the conversation further, but wished her good day and hung up. Selva went straight to the chest of drawers in their bedroom and found their passports. Since they had left Istanbul the day after they were married, she hadn't had time to change her surname. Her passport was still in her maiden name, Behija Selva Kurumlu. She had used this passport when she visited Italy with her parents, a year before she and Rafo left Turkey. The holiday had been organized by Luman Hanum in an attempt to patch things up between her husband and daughter. She'd chosen Italy because she knew how Fazıl Reşat Paşa admired the country. She had imagined that the magnificent sights, delicious food, and wonderful wines would heal the rift. Unfortunately, she had been too optimistic, and her hopes hadn't materialized. The two remained distant and talked to each other only when necessary. They returned home after a week still feeling resentful toward one another. Italy's ornamental architecture, the ice-cold frascati, and the various pasta dishes might have satisfied their senses, but had done nothing to warm their hearts. Selva toyed with the passports. Little Fazıl had fallen asleep in his bed. She decided that she would leave him with his father when he woke up and go to the consulate herself. She would tell Rafo that she was taking his passport too, and if she managed to get his extended, then she'd tell him why. The staff at the consulate might choose not to extend it, she thought. After all, Rafo had committed an unforgivable crime. Sacrilege, according to Sabiha. He had married a Muslim girl. Strangely enough, Turkish men who married Greek, Armenian, or Jewish girls weren't subject to the same treatment as Rafo. Turkish men could marry whom they pleased, but it wasn't the same for Turkish girls. Feelings of injustice filled Selva's heart as she put the passports in her bag. Just then, the telephone rang again.
Hello? Selva Hanum, this is Tarık Arıca from Paris again.
She now recognized his voice well.
I got you an appointment to visit the consulate. You are expected at 3:30 today. You needn't have trouble, Tarık Bey. I decided to go anyway. There's a long line at the gate. I didn't want you to have to go through all that, so I've given them your name. This way you can see the consul himself right away.
Selva was baffled as she put the phone down. Was this man crazy or what? Why had he taken it upon himself to make such a fuss? The line outside the consulate really surprised Selva. To the right of the gate, there was a crowd of middle-aged men and women talking among themselves and jostling one another. Selva did as Tarık had instructed. She went straight to the gate and rang the bell. The man who answered the door told her off in French.
You ought to have taken your line number from that man, he said, pointing.
Selva noticed an official standing on the other side of the gate.
I've come to see the consul. I've got an appointment.
What's your name?
Selva Kurumlu.
Wait here.
The consulate doorman, Akavas, returned shortly. He was much more courteous this time.
Please follow me, madam.
He led Selva up the stairs of the old building,
and they stopped at a desk in a hall where a secretary was sitting.
"Please take a seat,"
said the elderly secretary with an Armenian accent.
"The consul is engaged at the moment. I'll show you in as soon as he is free."
Selva sat on the edge of the chair in front of the desk and waited. 20 minutes later, the secretary announced that the consul was free. Selva stood up, straightened her skirt, ruffled her fringe, and strode down the long corridor to the consul's office. She waited a few seconds before knocking.
"Please come in,"
called a voice from the office. She opened the door and walked in. The young man sitting behind the desk leaped to his feet. He walked around the desk and shook Selva's hand. She was most surprised to see a tall, handsome man standing in front of her. She had expected the consul to be stout and bald.
"Hello, won't you sit down?"
Selva sat in an armchair.
"I'm Nazım Kender. Your brother-in-law Macit Bey is a colleague I admire a lot. Tarık Bey, our friend in Paris, tells me you are Sabiha Hanım's sister. When he telephoned, he told me to make this appointment for you. Why didn't you contact us yourself? I wish you had called and told me that you were Macit Bey's sister-in-law. Had I known you were here, I would have called you myself long ago. We try to get together with the Turks here at least once a month. Inshallah, you are all right. What can I do for you?"
Selva wondered if the man sitting across the desk knew about Rafo, if he knew that her husband was Jewish.
"I'd offer you something, but I'm sure you'll understand that in the present circumstances, supplies are short. We've even used up all the Turkish coffee that we had sent over last week."
"Thank you. I don't want anything to drink."
Selva was sitting on the edge of the chair rather anxiously.
"Tarık Bey told me that some documents needed updating. I understand your passports need extending."
"Yes, that's right. It was very kind of Tarık Bey to take the trouble to arrange this appointment. I had thought it wasn't really necessary, but I realized why when I saw the line outside."
"The lines? Yes, that's to do with the requirement that Turkish nationals have to register with the Turkish consulates. If they don't, they stand to lose their citizenship. Unfortunately, it appears that many of our Jewish citizens took no notice of this requirement. Why should they when they already obtained their French citizenship? In fact, some of them did nothing, purely out of negligence. Now, they are stateless. All they have are tattered old Ottoman passports written in Arabic. Now, because of the Vichy government's attitude, they are rushing to update them. What else can the poor souls do? The local authorities don't seem to be taking any circumstances into consideration, even one's age. They just gather people up, young and old, and send them to the camps. If they can show us anything to prove they were once Turkish citizens, we do our best to help them. Unfortunately, it isn't always easy. Sometimes there's nothing we can do. Because the Germans are hoping that we might join their side in the war, they don't seem to want to aggravate us too much. Anyway, enough of that. Your passports are Republic passports, of course, and I don't suppose it's a question of renewing them, of just extending them."
"Well, yes. They're not written in Arabic, but... I mean...
we can extend them right away."
"My husband's passport is out of date. Would you be able to extend that too?"
"Of course."
"I think I must tell you that my husband is Rafael Alfandari."
"He is a Turkish national, isn't he?"
"Yes, he's Turkish."
"So why should there be a problem?"
Selva fidgeted in her seat. It was obvious from her manner that she felt very uncomfortable.
"I hope I shall have the honor of meeting him," said the handsome man.
"You remember I told you that we organize get-togethers for the Turkish community from time to time. I sincerely hope you will accept our invitation to join us at our next gathering."
Selva's face brightened up. Hopefully the people she met here wouldn't be as condescending and hurtful as those she had considered her friends in Istanbul.
"Oh, thank you very much. We'd love to, of course."
"May I have your passports, please?"
Selva took the passports out of her bag.
I'm afraid our surnames aren't the same. Would you be able to correct that if I left my marriage license with you? She asked.
Selva broke the silence that followed.
We left Istanbul the day after our wedding, and we didn't have time to change my name on my passport.
Selva placed the passports together with the marriage license on the desk. The handsome consul looked through the pages of the license and appeared to be choosing his words carefully.
Selva Hanum, he said. Of course we can make the necessary changes, but since you have neglected to do this for so long, may I suggest not to do it just yet?
Why?
Selva said almost indignantly.
Because it's difficult to know what the Germans will do next. I don't recommend you change your name from Kurumla to Alfandari just yet. Let it stay the way it is. We are ready to help our Jewish citizens, I assure you, but as I said before, there are certainly times when our power doesn't go far enough. You have a young son, don't you?
How do you know that?
Taruk Bey told me. I firmly believe that you owe it to your son not to change anything until the war is over. I will certainly add your son's name to your passport.
What is it?
In other words, you expect me to save our skins and throw my husband to the devil, is that it?
You're exaggerating, Selva Hanum. I'm ready to do anything you say. I'm merely suggesting caution. Maybe you should discuss this with your husband before deciding.
He glanced at the names on the passports before adding, I'm sure Mr. Alfandari will agree with my advice.
Thank you, but the three of us are totally inseparable. Please make the appropriate changes. All three of us should have Alfandari on our passports.
Fine, as you wish. I sincerely congratulate you for your courage. Your husband is a very lucky man.
The handsome consul got up and showed Selva to the door. You can collect your updated passports in 2 days. Needless to say, if there is anything else I can do, don't hesitate to contact me.
Thank you. Thank you very much, sir.
Please convey my regards to Majid Bey and that very lovely sister of yours. You are in touch with them, aren't you?
We try to correspond, but unfortunately it isn't so easy. It takes ages for our letters to arrive, but what can one do?
Selva offered her hand, thanked the consul sincerely again, and left the room. She hurried down the corridor. When she returned home, she would tell her husband that the Turkish consul in Marseille was the best-looking man she had ever seen in her life. Paris. Taruk was banging the keys on his Remington typewriter with the intensity of a concert pianist. His body language reflected the words he was typing. He would raise one hand, nod, and strike a key, then raise the other hand, nod again, and so on, pausing from time to time to search for a particular letter. Taruk targeted the chosen letter before banging his finger down again, as if he was firing a gun.
Rat-a-tat-tat.
We, the Turkish Embassy, are honored to inform you of our government's views concerning your government's legal clause 2333, which was approved on 2-6-1941. According to this clause, Jewish people are required to register themselves and their possessions. This clause includes Jews of Turkish nationality. Turkey does not differentiate between its citizens on the grounds of race, color, or creed, and therefore is disturbed by this ruling from the French government. The Turkish government alone is responsible for protecting the rights of its citizens. The third secretary, Muhlis, sitting opposite Taruk, joked,
Why all this passion?
I'm using the kind of language these people understand.
They only understand blasphemy.
What a shame swear words aren't allowed in diplomacy.
I think you are giving vent to your feelings on that poor machine.
What do you expect? I've got to get it out of my system somehow. If only you knew what I went through last week.
Yes, I heard. If I hadn't been away delivering the courier bag, I could have joined you. I understand you saved Rivka Mitrani, Yakub Barbut, and Eli Farhi from the hands of the Gestapo. I saw the thank you notes they sent this morning, so I remember the names. It was really tragic. You should have heard Mitrani's daughter's voice on the phone. It was heartbreaking to hear her sobbing, yelling and screaming that they'd taken her mother away. Where to? They brought her from Lyon to Paris. They were going to send her to Drancy. Sometimes they send them to Berlin by train.
Yes, and after that nobody knows what happens.
That's right. I never knew civilized people could behave this way. Why this animosity? Why?
I wish I knew. If I ever meet Hitler one day, I'd like to ask him, said Mulis.
You never know. Maybe he was cuckolded by a Jewish beauty when he was young. Don't they say there's always a woman's finger behind everything? Cherchez la femme.
Mulis Edin was very new at the consulate. There had been an enormous increase in the number of passport queries after Taruk was posted to Paris, so he was given an assistant. Unlike Taruk, who was serious and hard-working, Mulis didn't take life too seriously. He was frivolous and made light of everything. Taruk hadn't quite made up his mind whether or not he liked this young man. He had to admit, though, that in these dismal days, Mulis did manage to make him laugh and lighten the atmosphere a little. But Taruk wasn't quite sure how much he could trust him.
My dear Mulis Bey, you better set these jokes aside. One day you may be faced with a similar situation, and then what?
Right, I was just about to ask you. What exactly did you do after you got that call?
I called the German embassy in Paris immediately. I insisted that the person in question was Turkish. They, in turn, asked for her papers. It is always extremely important to have all the relevant documents in order. The girl sent her mother's birth certificate with her husband, and then the young man traveled all night to bring it to me. He was totally exhausted when he got here. We were about to jump into my Citroën to go to the police station when there was another call. Apparently there were another two at the same station. Anyway, thank God we seem to get some respect from the Germans at the moment. You know they're buying chrome from us now. Anyhow, we got there. I don't know if you remember that I saved another two from a different police station last week. I think I'm getting good at this. You should have seen the joy, all the hugs and tears when we crammed into the car later. The poor woman couldn't stop crying. She kept trying to hug and thank me while I was driving. No matter how many times I warned her not to distract me, she kept trying to give me sloppy kisses. She just didn't seem to understand. We could easily have had an accident. The others were similar. Jakob was in shock, so he could hardly talk, and the other one kept praying in all the different languages he knew. Finally, tearfully, we got here. What I am trying to emphasize is that if people have the necessary papers to prove they are Turkish, you shouldn't hesitate for a minute. After making your formal applications, you need to follow up personally and with insistence. If necessary, you should also contact the Turkish embassy in Vichy for further pressure. If that doesn't work, you should also seek assistance from our embassy in Berlin.
I understand, said Mulis. So then what happened?
Then we took all their old papers and replaced them with solid Turkish passports. They were so grateful. They thanked us 1,000 times and left the office.
Didn't you ask them why the hell they had left Turkey to come here?
No! For God's sake, how can you ask those questions at such a time? Don't we wish we were Europeans at times? Don't we envy the Europeans' level of civilization, their knowledge, their order? Those poor souls must have felt the same way. Well, they got up and left. What a mistake!
Just as Mulis was going to answer, they were interrupted by a secretary.
The consul is waiting for that letter, sir. He's asking if it is finished yet, the petite brunette said.
I'll bring it over in 10 minutes, said Taruk,
and he went back to striking the keys. Rat-a-tat-tat. Marseille. Selva was thinking of the good news she had for Rafo on her way home.
Before returning to their apartment, she went to the pharmacy to collect Fazul. Rafo had put his son in his high chair behind the counter. He had given him a piece of paper and some colored pencils to amuse himself. As soon as he saw Selva, he lifted the boy up and handed him to his mother.
"Where have you been?"
he asked in an irritated voice.
"Sorry, I only just made it. Why, has something happened?"
"For goodness sake, don't ask silly questions. They took Rosa and her kid away. Benoit ran to the police station. I was waiting for you before I could join him."
Selva hugged her son tightly, and Rafo continued.
"It seems they rounded them up just as they were getting on the bus today. They were carrying out an identity check. We received the news about 20 minutes after you left."
Rafa was already putting on his jacket.
"Come on, Selva. You better go home. I need to lock the door."
"Rafa, wait. I have to talk to you first."
"What's there to talk about? I can't leave Benoit alone. He was so sad, almost desperate."
"I understand, but maybe I could help him."
"Who? You?"
"Yes."
"Just who do you think you are? Being Fazul Reshat Pasha's daughter won't get you very far in Marseille."
"What are you saying, Rafo?"
"I'm sorry, Selva, I'm on edge right now, and you're making me late. I had to leave Benoit on his own because of you. If you hadn't left Fazul, I would have been able to join him."
"Rafo, you've got to come home with me. You must tell me exactly where they took them and what time. I need their full names and addresses and
what will you do with these details, may I ask?
Will you go to the police station and say, 'Listen here, you, I am Madame Alfandari. You will regret your actions.'"
Finally, Selva had to raise her voice.
"Shut up, Rafo! Shut up and listen!"
Rafo wasn't used to his wife speaking to him in that tone.
"Rafo, let's call the consul I saw today. I'm sure he can help."
"You're being ridiculous now."
He led Selva by the arm out of the pharmacy, closed the door, pulled the shutters down, and locked up.
"Come on, darling, go home. I might be late for dinner, but I'll be back as soon as I can."
"Aren't you even going to ask what I did today?"
"We'll speak when I get back," said Rafo.
Selva crossed the street with her son cradled in her arms and went home.
"Now then, little one, please don't be difficult. Play in there," she said, putting Fazul in his playpen. "I need to make a call now, and then I'll get you something to eat. Okay? Will that be okay?"
The child looked as though he would resist at first, but seeing the determined look on his mother's face, he picked up his little red truck and began to play. Selva looked through the notebooks by the telephone and found the piece of paper on which he'd written the consul's telephone number.
"Hello? Is this the Turkish consulate? I'd like to speak to Nazım Kender, the consul, please. It's very urgent." "Yes, very urgent indeed. This is Selva Kurumlu. I came to see him this afternoon. Would you tell him that..." "Yes, I'll wait. Thank you."
Selva put her fingers to her lips to indicate to her son that he should be quiet.
"Hello? Yes, yes, it's me, Selva Kurumlu, Mr. Kender. I'm sorry to disturb you, but apparently, as I was seeing you this afternoon, they took away someone very close to me, together with her son. Actually, she's my husband's business partner's cousin. Yes, on his mother's side. They're a family from Istanbul."
Selva started sobbing, drowning her voice in her tears.
"I don't really know where. I'll see if I can find out. Her name is Rosa. Rosa Hatem. Her child's name is Yako. Their address is... My God, what is it now? 48 Rue Boissière. I'm sure that's right. Yes, that's right. I understand that her husband is in the hospital. He had a gallbladder operation 3 days ago. I presume he knows nothing of this. Please help. I beg of you, Mr. Kender." "Thank you. I can't thank you enough."
Selva put the phone down, went into the kitchen and made sure that the door was closed so Fazul wouldn't hear her crying. Lyon. Rivka was busily preparing pastries in the kitchen when the telephone started to ring. Rivka's family had originally emigrated from Toledo to Istanbul, and not even 27 years in Paris had changed her taste in food or the customs surrounding it. Passover was approaching, and Rivka had already prepared a list of food she would be cooking for her small family, as well as the unleavened bread for the meal. What a pity, though, that she had left behind in Paris the special china she had for such a holy occasion. There were actually far more important things than plates that she had had to leave behind, but if she had them, she would be busy washing them now for the Seder feast. Her first reaction was to ignore the telephone. It was probably for her daughter anyway, and she wasn't at home. However, when the ringing persisted, she hurried to the sitting room, wiping her hands on her apron.
"Hello," she said.
She listened to the voice on the end of the line for a while, slowly turning pale, and finally reaching out for a nearby chair to sit on. She started rocking back and forth, hitting her knees with her fist. After replacing the receiver, she ran to the kitchen and picked up a sharp knife. She opened the front door and tried to prise off the mezuzah nailed to the top right-hand corner of the doorframe. Rivka Mitrani had moved from Paris to Lyon. After the First World War, she and her husband had left Istanbul to live in Paris. Originally, her ancestors had migrated from Spain to Istanbul in 1492. That move was a direct result of the imperial declaration signed by the Spanish king, Don Ferdinand, and his queen, Donna Isabella, in March of that year. It commanded the Jews, who were considered to be heretics, to leave the country by July and never to return. Those who disobeyed this order and stayed, or even came back, would be executed no matter what their age or gender. Furthermore, they were to liquidate all their assets and leave behind all their money, together with their gold, silver, and jewelry. At the same time, Bayezid II, the 8th Sultan of the Ottoman Empire, issued an invitation to the 250,000 Jews banished by Spain to come to his country. Leaving everything behind, they boarded old, run-down ships for the dreadful journey to the only country offering them refuge. Some 500 years later, Morris Caraco, one of the descendants of those refugees, would write about the experience. "The Ottomans sincerely greeted us and gave us accommodation. We were free to practice our religion and to speak our own language. We were even protected from those who wanted to banish us yet again to foreign lands. Our honor and dignity were restored." Bayezid II's statement at the time was,
"It is said that Ferdinand is a wise king. However, the truth of the matter is that by getting rid of the Jews, he has made his country poorer and mine richer."
The refugees settled in their new country, becoming prosperous and happy. But their new homeland wasn't without its own problems. For centuries, its inhabitants endured destitution and hardship. Toward the end of the 19th century, the 500-year-old empire had started to fall apart, piece by piece. As the Jews accumulated considerable fortunes through commerce, they started to spread to different areas and different countries. Many moved to glamorous France, particularly to its brightest star, Paris, which in those days was the center of civilization, art, and leisure. Nesim Mitrani, Rivka's husband, established a financial company in Paris. By the time their first child, Maurice, was born, they'd not only become a well-to-do family, but they'd also obtained solid French passports. Rivka hadn't the heart to throw away the tatty old passports written in Arabic script, so she put them in the hatbox where she kept her old family photographs. She was as faithful to her religion as she was to the traditions passed on from her grandmothers, the Ladino language, and the memorabilia that reminded her of her past. She kept everything with nostalgic significance, and this instinct was typical of people who are always on the move.
"Our home isn't a home," her husband would say. "It's a flea market."
From banking, their wealth accumulated over the years, and Rivka continued to collect her knickknacks. By the time their daughter was born, they had become extremely rich. They would spend their summer holidays in the south of France, and in the winter send the children skiing in the Alps. They lived in one of the most elegant districts in Paris, shopped at Faubourg Saint-Honoré, and dined at the most expensive restaurants. By now, instead of knickknacks,
Rivka was collecting antiques and rare objets d'art from auctions. But the good life came to an abrupt end in 1940, as though lightning had struck. The transfer of Mitrani's very own company to a French Catholic businessman took just 3 days. Nassim Mitrani had thought that losing his company and fortune was the greatest disaster he would have to endure, but he was wrong. One day, while he was organizing his family's move to the south of France, away from the occupation, the Gestapo took him and his son and transported them to Drancy. They were never heard from again. Rivka managed to escape to Lyon with her daughter, Constance. She hoped they would be able to start a new life there. Even though the French government appeared to be pro-Hitler, she and Constance held French passports after all. The days of wine and roses might be over. They found it hard to cope with the loss of their loved ones, but life had to go on. Constance went to the university in Lyon, and there she met a young Frenchman and married him. Her husband was of Jewish descent, but he was not like her family. He was 7th generation French. Because of his love for Constance, he had agreed to live with his mother-in-law, despite their different tastes in food and music. The young couple didn't have a lot of money, so they both had to work. When they came home tired in the evening, there was always a bowl of hot soup and something else that Rivka had prepared. As a result of what had happened to her son and husband, Rivka had lost almost all interest in life herself. She was also suffering from a heart condition. She would go out shopping early in the morning, then cook food for the youngsters to come home to. In her free time, she would visit the synagogue and pray for her loved ones. Her only joy was the rare occasion when she got news from old friends and relatives, most of whom had dispersed all over the world. Those who had the means had escaped to America. Some had returned to Turkey, and others had done as they had and moved to various cities in the south of France. It was true that Rivka had no friends in Lyon, but the monotony of her life gave her a certain peace. She couldn't remove the mezuzah with the knife, so she looked for a screwdriver in the drawers. When Constance came home around lunchtime, Rivka was still struggling at the front door.
"For goodness sake, mother, what on earth are you doing?"
"Oh, Constance, I don't know how to tell you this. Bad news, my dear. Rachel telephoned today from Marseille."
"Which Rachel?"
"How many Rachels are there, Constance? Rosa's mother."
"Why did she phone?"
"Dear, dear Constance, are we ever going to find peace on this earth?"
"What happened? Tell me, mother."
"The damned collaborators. The police took Rosa and her child to the police station."
"My God!"
Rivka began sobbing. It took her ages to tell Constance exactly what happened.
"In other words, the Turkish consul managed to save them, is that it?"
"That's right. Rachel thought she should tell me so we can be careful ourselves."
"Don't you have a Turkish passport, mother? The way you heard everything, I bet you still have it. Why don't you check?"
"Don't you remember the way we left Paris, my dear? I couldn't even take a spare pair of shoes, let alone the box where I kept that tattered old passport."
Constance noticed her mother still struggling with the screwdriver.
"Stop it, mother. You'll hurt yourself. Marcel can do that when he comes home this evening."
"I suppose I can always nail it to the top of my bedroom door,"
Rivka said, wiping her nose.
"You can put it where you like,"
replied Constance, shrugging her shoulders.
"As long as you stay away from the synagogue area. I beg you, mother, this is serious. Give me Auntie Rachel's phone number so I can call her. I bet they must have been petrified."
"They were lucky," said Rivka. "They were in one day and out the next."
Unfortunately, Rivka was not to be so lucky and was soon caught up in the web herself. Even though she had promised Constance that she wouldn't visit the synagogue, one day she couldn't resist going to pray. As she entered the synagogue, the Gestapo rounded her up, together with the other Jews there. She struggled desperately, protesting strongly, saying she was Turkish.
but no one listened. She was forced into a police car and taken to the police station, and from there in a bus to the train station and thence to Paris. The train was absolutely crammed full. Once in the Paris police station, she and many others were lined up against the wall in a hallway before being sent to Drancy. A German officer called out her name.
Rivka Mitrani, take one step forward.
Rivka thought she was going to be shot. At last she could join her husband and son. She took a step forward and followed the man to the end of the hallway. A young man was sitting in a tiny room speaking to the police officers. He asked Rivka to sign some documents before taking her to his Citroën. There were already two men sitting in the back of the car.
"Where are you taking me, monsieur?" she asked.
"Where do you want to go, madame?"
"To my daughter."
"That's where I'm taking you."
"To Lyon?"
"No, madame, to the Turkish consulate, where your son-in-law is waiting."
When Rivka realized that she had been saved, she hugged and kissed this man driving the car. But she felt ashamed doing so, not because she was smothering a young man with kisses, but because she felt so happy to have been saved from death, and then she remembered her son and husband. She shuddered, thinking that she had faced death so bravely. It's interesting, she thought, that one isn't scared of death from a distance, but when it's staring you in the face, it feels like a merciless enemy that you desperately want to avoid. Back in Lyon, another surprise awaited Rivka. Her daughter and son-in-law announced that in a few weeks they intended to cross the mountains into Spain. They would wait for sunset and then cross through the passes under the cover of darkness. They were already preparing to put their plan into action.
"Listen, children, I can't scramble over the Pyrenees at my age. I'm bound to have a heart attack and die on the way," she said.
"But mother, you'll die if you stay here too. The Nazis won't leave us alone. At least give yourself a chance,"
her daughter insisted.
"Constance, I promise you, I will not set one foot through this door. Please drop that idea."
"Mother, it's all right for you to say you won't go out, but what about us?"
"What about you? Surely you're not in as much danger as I am."
"And how?"
"But why? Nobody would know you're Jewish. You don't even have a Jewish accent."
"Mother, it's about time you knew. Marcel has been working for the Résistance. Some of those who are working in his cell have been caught already. It is impossible for us to stay here safely. We have to leave France as soon as possible."
Rivka listened in awe. Marcel wanted to cross to Spain immediately, but his mother-in-law refused to return to the country that had caused her people indescribable pain and driven them away.
"All that happened centuries ago. What's the point of dwelling on it?" Marcel argued.
"You can go. I'll stay here. After all, what difference does it make whether I end up in the hands of the Germans or the Spaniards? As if that wasn't enough, you'd also expect me to scramble over the mountains like a goat. At my age and with my heart condition. What for? To end up being degraded? Never!"
"Mother, you're being ridiculous. Is this the way to behave because something that happened in the 15th century? Don't you realize that you're putting us in danger? I already told you that they captured two men from Marcel's Résistance cell. If they are made to talk, it will be the end of us. Can't you see that? For God's sake, be sensible. We have to get away, and the sooner the better."
"You'd better go then."
Constance firmly believed that her mother would change her mind, so she waited patiently for her to say yes. She and Marcel kept on the move. They stayed with friends for a couple of nights and then moved on to others, constantly changing their abode. But Rivka had a plan. She wrote to the Turkish consul who had saved her from the Gestapo. She wondered if the consulate would be able to issue passports to her daughter and son-in-law as well. She pleaded with them in her letter. If necessary, she was willing to relinquish hers in exchange for the two. Anything, as long as the Turkish consulate could spread its wings over her children.
Ankara, 1942. Leman Hanum untied the satin ribbon from around the dusty pink box. She took some photographs out of the box and spread them on her bed. Her entire life was spread out before her, captured in sepia-colored photographs glued to thick brown cards. She picked up one photo at random. There she was with her wavy hair held up by a huge bow and cascading across her shoulders and down onto her chest. She was leaning against her father's knees with a bouquet of flowers in her hand. Her childhood was staring back at her with wide-eyed innocence. Her father sat proudly in a carved armchair. In another photograph, taken at the famous Mikhailidis studio, her hair was up in a bun with strands of bridal silver hanging from the top of her head to the floor. She appeared so fragile in her tiered lace dress. Her waist was so tiny that she looked as if a puff of wind would blow her away. In another picture, she was wearing the same clothes, but this time her husband was standing beside her. He had a fine, twisted mustache and a fez that came down to the center of his forehead. He looked so tall, handsome, and wide-shouldered in his aide-de-camp uniform. Leman Hanum took a deep breath, put the pictures down, and rummaged again through the box. The next photo she picked up had been taken at the Photo Sabha studio. They were of her children, to her the most beautiful girls in the world. Every year without fail they would have their photographs taken on their birthdays. Even though the pictures were in black and white, one could immediately see the sparkle in Sabiha's eyes and the shine in her blonde hair. She was spring-like, fresh and beautiful. Next to her was Selva, with her huge eyes and plaited hair. Although one could tell from some pictures that she was the younger of the two, in most she appeared to be looking down at her sister from above. What was it that Sabiha had said that day at the studio? Leman Hanum smiled as she remembered.
Mother, I'd like to sit down for the photograph. Selva can stand beside me.
That's not possible, my darling. If you sit and she stands, we can't get you both in the same frame,
said Enver Bey, the owner of the studio, not knowing how much that upset Sabiha.
She should sit down and you stand beside her.
Sabiha immediately began to sulk. Where on earth had this complex about her height come from? It was ridiculous that a girl as beautiful as she was should worry so much about her height. Leman Hanum continued to rummage through the photographs until she found what she was looking for. The last photo taken of Selva before she left. She was wearing a simple beige two-piece, with her plaited hair up around her head as usual. Slender and elegant, Selva was sitting at the table in the registry office on her wedding day, signing the registry wearing her wedding ring. No other jewelry, no tiny diamond ring, no brooch on her lapel, no string of pearls around her neck, and she was supposed to be a bride. Leman Hanum felt tears running down her cheeks. Oh, my darling Selva, why, oh, why did you do this? My stubborn little baby. What I would have given to see you in a long veil with strands of bridal silver, looking like a perfect bride. How I wish that I could have given you one of the family heirlooms to wear on your wedding day. She kissed her daughter's photograph with longing and pressed it to her heart. She was sure that there were three or four other photographs taken that day. She looked through the box and found them. In one that Majid must have taken, the two sisters were standing side by side with that disgusting Rafo behind them. One wouldn't know that it was Rafo, because Leman Hanum had scratched his face off with a pin. In another, obviously taken by Rafo, Majid was standing between Selva and Sabiha. The last photograph of the wedding group must have been taken by someone at the registry office. How difficult it had been for Leman Hanum to hide these photographs from her husband. She had not put them in the family album and took special care to hide them at the bottom of her box. As if Fazıl Reşat Paşa would bother to look for them. Anyway, she didn't want to take the chance. He might tear them up. They were, after all, the last photographs she had of her darling daughter, her tall, slender daughter in her beige two-piece suit. The photographs might have faded, but her beloved daughter was always so vividly in her mind and heart. When she heard the door open, she quickly slipped the photographs under the pillow.
"You're not looking at those photographs again, are you, Granny?"
asked her granddaughter as she entered the room.
"Yes, I am, my darling, I am." "Don't you get tired of looking at them over and over?" "No, I don't. They're my whole life. They're my past." "You say that, Granny, but you don't look at all of them. I know which ones you're looking at." "Really? And which ones are they?" "Photos of my aunt." "Do you miss her a lot?" "A lot, yes. I miss her a lot." "Why doesn't she visit us in the summer? Even if she's working, she could come for her summer holidays, couldn't she? I'd love to see little Fazul. If only she'd bring him to us." "There's war all around, my little darling. There's war where your auntie lives. They just can't come now. I'm sure they will, though. Inshallah, when the war is over." "Has Grandpa forgiven her, then?" "What sort of question is that?" "Come on, Granny, I know. Apparently Grandpa was very angry because she married that man." "Who told you that? Your mother?" "No, Hajir."
Leman Hanum frowned. How tactless staff can be, she thought. Not only do they have an answer for everything, they also listen to everything. Those were the days when they were so devoted, when they were almost members of the family. Those were the days indeed.
"How inappropriate of her. There are things one doesn't discuss with children." "Oh, don't say that, Granny. I'm not a child. I'll be 9 next month." "Don't exaggerate, child. You'll be 8. You're in such a hurry to get older, aren't you? Wait until you do get older, and then it will be the reverse,"
Leman Hanum replied, handing the photographs to her grandchild.
"Time just flies by," she said with a sigh. "It's almost 5 years since your Auntie Selva left. Do you remember her, Julia?" "Yes, I do, Granny. She read fairy tales to me in the evenings and often took me to Kuzule Park. I remember drinking mineral water out of huge glasses." "Granny, could you show me the photograph of my auntie holding a bunch of daisies?"
Leman Hanum looked for the photograph of Selva wearing a white dress clinging to her figure, with layers and layers of petal-shaped chiffon hanging from the hips, the one in which she was holding a bunch of daisies. Daisies were Selva's favorite flowers. They are just like Selva, Leman Hanum thought. Maybe a little wild, but certainly down to earth. She remembered how the pollen from the daisies had stained the gorgeous dress. She eventually found the photograph and looked at it, trying to hold back floods of tears. Selva looked rather sad in the photograph. There was a kind of melancholy in her eyes. Of course, Leman Hanum thought. The picture was taken at the American College on her graduation day. She must have been thinking that it wouldn't be easy to continue seeing that wretched fellow Raphael.
There you are. Here it is. Isn't your auntie beautiful?
Julia took the picture and looked at it for a while. She gazed at Selva's sad face that looked as if it were carved out of marble. Then she looked at the other photos spread out on the bed and saw a picture of her mother as a teenager. Her oval face was framed by wavy hair as she pensively rested her chin on her hand.
"My mother is more beautiful, but, you know, Granny, I wish I were my aunt's daughter." "What do you mean? Why is that?" "I think my aunt loved me more than my mother."
Leman Hanum froze on the spot. For a moment, she was speechless.
"Really, Julia? Where did that come from? Is it possible that your mother doesn't love you? You're her one and only daughter, for God's sake."
"Frankly, Granny,
I think she's bored with me. She never seems to want to spend any time with me.
Do you need to be entertained all the time? You know that because of your father's job, she needs to accompany him here, there, and everywhere. She has to go to dinners and cocktail parties whether she wants to or not.